someone has to watch this. All right, today's agenda is here. The main topic today is measuring and analyzing physiological signals, part one. So we're going to go through this next week in a bit more detail. But I was hoping that we have enough time today so that we can have a glimpse of how MATLAB works. And then next time, after some of you have recovered from the shock, you'll be ready to actually do something with it. This doesn't necessarily apply to all of you, but I know that in some people, doing something from the command line causes major anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But trust me, it's actually quite rewarding to do something like MATLAB. Okay, but before we start that, we'll go through the not in much detail, your last week's assignments. And then we're going to talk about the equipment that is usually found in laboratory settings and how do they work. And how do they record the signal, and what is the basic properties of the physiological signal? It all boils down to a very basic principles. So it's not very complicated thing that we record. Analyzing it is complicated. And then, yes, we're going to have some views on how to do very basic signal processing. I'm talking about averaging, induced evoked activity and stuff like that, frequency analysis. And then what kind of software do we have available to do this analysis? We are not going to use Brain Vision Analyzer, which is a commercial software. We have required that I bought as many licenses as there are people here, which would have been quite expensive. Last year, we actually, for this course, we had some, we call them sample, a tryout period donors for this, but then again, not many people here is using Brain Vision Analyzer, so it's better to stick with MATLAB, which is MATLAB itself is also a commercial software, but the toolboxes that have been made on it are usually free to download. And MATLAB is a very good thing if you want to be a scientist. It's a good thing to know the basics of it, because lots of things can be done with it. And lots of stuff can be downloaded, made by other researchers for your specific purposes. Okay, but first, thanks for all your assignments that I got. I casually, quite briefly, went through all of them, except those that I received this morning. And I'll now give you some really common feedback on them. Just some issues that I think was brought up. And then we'll go on with the other things. Okay, first thing I noticed that actually it was in many of those your designs, was that there was actually three groups. There was this experimental group that this applies to those who went with the intelligence drug, and also this applies to marijuana. So you had three groups, one that got the actual medicine, another group that was given placebo, and a third group that was given nothing. And the purpose of this third group was to deal with the effect of repetition or rehearsal effects. Now, I'm not quite sure whether you actually need that third group in most of the cases, because it's a you would have the same amount of training in every group anyway. But if you are interested in that training effect per se, then you would need to add that group C. But it's not that frequently used, I think. I mean, it's not wrong to have it, but it's in terms of how much work would you be willing to invest in your experiment. I think the gains ratio is not that high. And one thing that relates to this is, if I remember correctly, no one used actually a certain method to deal with the with the fact that if you are going to measure intelligence twice, like 2 weeks apart, or 3 days, as some of you suggested, of course there's a problem that if you ask them some questions, how would you answer to this, and then you ask the same question 2 weeks from that moment, of course they will have rehearsed. So there's a problem, because it's pretty obvious that people tend to have higher scores as a function of time anyway. But there is a way around this, and it's called counterbalancing. Koeasetelman tasapainottaminen in Finnish. It's usually useful to have two versions of the test, as there are actually in many memory tests there are two versions of it, because if we put someone under surveillance, like we suspect that some person is having early symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, we want to keep track on her or his performance. So we could do some intelligence or memory tests from, let's say, 6 months apart, every 6 months the test. So we can see whether there's a decline in performance. But usually it's a problem if you use the same tests, because of course there's this rehearsing effect. But one way of going around that is to use two different versions of the test. Now it's usually common to have something like, I'm now reading you 20 items, 20 things, please repeat these after 5 minutes or something. And then this person does that and can produce an X amount of those items. But how about if the next time this person comes to your study, you would have a different list of items? So then you could somehow at least diminish the effect of training. But can you see any problems with this approach? Let's say that we have questionnaire A and questionnaire B. They are the same test, but they have different items, different questions. But they somehow are recording the same thing. And you do this A first, and then you have a treatment, and then you do B. And you can possibly see if there's an improvement or decline or whatever. But this is now going like it should be.
It should be the other way as well.
Yes.
Start with the B.
Yes. Yes. That's called counterbalancing. So for half of the subjects, you do this first and then this. But for the other half of the subjects, you do B first and then A. Then you can somehow control for the effect of the brain. Of course, there are still some general effects of being tested twice that affects. But that's usually something we just have to deal with, have to live with. Okay. Then, of course, most of you who did something related to this, like neural correlate of anything, aesthetic pleasure or mind reading or whatever, you quite well identified the problem that if you record brain activity related to something and then you record brain activity related to something else, and you make a distraction, subtraction, then you would have something that reflects, let's say, experiencing pleasure. But it's very difficult because the brain does all kinds of things all the time. So if we are trying to grasp something like pleasure, it's very difficult. But you all have identified these problems. This is a good thing. Some of your, most of, if not all of your experiments were very well designed. So they would work technically. But then in ethical sense, some of the experiments would probably not be allowed. You know what I'm talking about. one group would have caused depression in patients, in people. I mean, it's okay to have, because that the question was that depression causes dysfunction in the brain area X. Now, of course, it's a causal inference. And the only way to deal with causality in science is doing an experiment where you manipulate something. And in this case, it would have to, the depression would have to be caused. And it was a very clever thing how they would cause it. If I remember, I had to Google this because I didn't know that, but side effect of acne treatment supposedly causes depression in teenagers. So that's very clever. I was amused by this. But I saw a slight ethical issue. But of course, if you did that with a rat, it would still be an ethical issue, but it might be something that you could do. But of course, depression in a rat might be a different thing than a depression in humans. So there's no way of designing a perfect experiment. And I liked your approach too. The question was whether using marijuana would improve cognition. I must say that's a bit original line of thought here, but in a technical sense it was okay.
We are creating a theory.
All right. Yeah, there was a lack of theory. I would have wanted to read some speculations about the possible mechanisms, how would that work. Because from what I know, what I have read, it's usually the opposite. Okay. So causation is the target and the goal of experimental work, but it's sometimes quite tricky to achieve. But generally speaking, you did very well. I'll mark your assignments soonish. I'll try to give you all some feedback on what might have been a bit problematic. All right then. Let's talk about how to record something, how to set up a laboratory. And the reason I bring this up is not that you would be building a laboratory yourself, but it's a good thing to know how the signal is gathered. And it's a good thing to be able to speak engineers even a bit, so that whenever something goes wrong, you can explain what is going wrong, and then the engineer is actually trying to explain why is it that way, you can use that. So this is the usual setup. We have two computers. We have a computer that stores the information that you record, and we have another computer that generates and controls all the signals. And there must be a link between them two. Sometimes it's possible to use just one computer to do both, but this is very common. But you have separate computers for controlling the experiment and recording. Then we have, of course, we have the subject equipped with some things on her, his or her head, which is connected to an amplifier, which is connected to this acquisition computer. And then here, well, this is a bit more straightforward. We have a computer that controls for auditory stimuli, or I don't know, I'm not sure what it is, but it could be anything. Some external device that is triggered by a computer-generated signal. Of course, the computer itself could generate tones and pictures and whatever. So let's go through this circuit. In brief, we have those things on the measurement side. So we have a person or an animal or a slice of tissue or whatever that we want to record for that organism. And then we have something that we attach to this organism that's only function is to convert something into voltage. It's called transducer or sensor or electrode or whatever. That's connected to an amplifier, and the reason, of course, is that whatever you are going to record from the human body is usually very, very low in amplitude. So you have to amplify that, and you need to be certain that you amplify the signal, not the noise. So that's where the filter is, comes in. And there are different stages of amplification and filtering. They could be the other way around. Then we're going to go through with some detail here. What does the analog to digital converter do? Because nowadays everything is digital. We store everything to a computer. A computer doesn't store any curves or anything like that. It's just those numbers. And there are some possible caveats there that needs to be taken into account. And then, of course, we have the acquisition computer that stores everything. In the old days, this was just a plotter which drew the actual signal. Now I think they are still being used in ambulances and in some hospital settings where you need to have a quick readout of something. Like a heart rate, the cardiogram, or anything like that. Speaking of which, all signals that we are all this applies to practically every signal that you can record from the human body. So the equipment is quite the same, be it brain activity, heart rate, sweating, breathing, whatever, behavior, muscle activity.
Usually we use the filter after we record or while we are recording.
We can apply filters during very many stages during this process. Of course, it's usually the first step in the signal analysis as well afterwards.
Yeah.
But in some cases, you don't want to record mains noise, for instance. You can filter that out even during the recording. Or if you are interested in EMG, you could exclude all the slow activity because you're not going to use that anyway. So the electrode or a sensor or whatever you might want to call it, its only job is to convert something that we are interested in into voltage. Because voltage is what goes in the system. Voltage is a function of time, to be specific. And an electrode is a very paramount example of this. You have two electrodes, and what we're actually recording is the voltage difference between two points. but that said, anything can, with some imagination, anything could be converted into voltage, because voltage is everything we can record, actually. So there are a couple of examples in here how to convert like movement into something that a computer can record. So for instance, if you are interested in, this is an example in rabbits, we are interested in their eye blinks, when they blink. Of course, one approach is to put an EMG electrodes into the around the eye. But another possibility is a more non-invasive or less invasive is to direct some infrared light to its eye, and it reflects back. We can record how much light is reflecting back. We have a sensor that transduces infrared energy into voltage, and when the animal closes its eye, there's nothing coming back, so we can, and when the eyelid is in halfway, there's just some amount of light reflecting back, so we can infer its eye blinks. That can be used in humans too. The only problem is that infrared is a bit annoying because it generates a bit of heat and it dries up the eye. So it's usually wise not to put that on all the time. You can record velocity, you can transduce acceleration into voltage with accelerometers. Well, I actually don't know how they work inside. But when they move, they generate voltage that they put forward. Well, there are certain electrodes that respond to stretching. That's very useful if you are interested in breathing rate. You just put a band over the chest, and whenever a person breathes, the chest expands, and that thing stretches a bit. This generates a difference in voltage. Our lab technician once suggested, when we were interested in breathing in rabbits, the breathing rate. How would you record that? Well, of course, you can apply the same thing, but he actually came up with a very clever idea. We put a very fast responding thermometer in front of its nose. And of course, when the animal exhales, it's a warmer air than during the inhale. So it will fluctuate at the rhythm of the animal's breathing. So pressure can be converted into voltage, and a very common example is the microphone. It has a diaphragm that vibrates when the air vibrates, and that gets transduced into voltage. Okay, so there we have a sensor. And the next step is the amplification. We usually talk about pre and main amplifiers. Nowadays, active electrodes are quite common. we have them too here. That's kind of a pre-amplifier too. But the idea is that the first stage in amplification should be very close to the sensor. Because if you connect the sensor to an amplifier with a 1 meter long lead, the amplification comes after the lead, and any noise that affects that lead would also get amplified. So that's why the first stage of amplification is very close to the subject. That's why you don't want to use very long wires coming from the subject to the amplifier. And in the case of active electrons, they have the first stage of amplification usually just there. So there is no wire that could pick up noise from the ambient noise that's always there. So ideally, you want to locate this stage as close to the subject as possible. It's very common nowadays, though, that the amplifier itself, it's just one box which contains both stages, pre and main amplification. But the purpose of this main amplifier, this gets a bit more obvious in a moment when I really go through the workings of the AD converter. But let's say that we have a dynamic range. We can see phenomena that range from, let's say, minus 10 to 10 volts. And then we have a physiological signal which is actually, we are talking about microvolts. So if you think about that 20 volt range and a microvolt, 100 microvolts would be just a straight line if it wasn't amplified. So we amplify that and we get it to fill up a bit of that space, but the main amplification can be used to fill that completely so that we can have a maximal resolution for the signal. This has something to do with the bit rate of the AD converter, which I come back to soon. But we usually talk about total amplification, which is this times that. And sometimes this is referred to as gain. So it's usually, this is usually a couple of thousands, and this is like 4 to 10 or 20 or something like that. It's a very small number in comparison to this. Those of you who are into audio hi-fi know that there are pre and main amplifiers there too. And the main amplifier is just a block. It doesn't do anything. It does lots of things, but there are no buttons. But there's a pre amplifier that has the volume button. And then this main amplifier that just gives everything it has all the time. So same thing here. This is quite crude. It's just used so that we can fill up the dynamic range of our recording. Don't worry if you don't get it now, you'll soon will.
Is there any distortion in the signal with the amplifier?
Yes, of course. Anything that is processed in any way, there's always some amount of distortion. So that's why, that's a good question actually, because usually it's not very wise to use the notch filter, which is the used to, I have it here. Because notch filter is something that you can use to reduce the noise in the signal that is generated by the line frequency that we have here. It's 50 Hz in Finland. And if your setting where you do the recordings is not very well electrically isolated, you will have that noise there. You can put a filter on that filters it out, but then you will lose something that's in the signal itself. So it's usually very wise not to use that, except that if you want to use that just for displaying purposes that you can see a reasonable signal, but you can store anything, and then afterwards you can apply these filters. Yeah, every time you filter, you lose something. Mm-hmm. It's not a...
And is there a dispersion? Mm. Dispersion?
I'm not sure what you mean by dispersion.
When you lose some...
Yeah, you lose some information, like
yes.
In the near-infrared, for example.
Oh, yeah.
There is a kind of
yes.
formula to calculate
yes.
the
yes.
dispersion with the linked and the...
Yes, yeah. You will lose.
Yeah.
Because there's no way of doing filtering or any kind of signal processing so that I will just pick this crucial information without either losing something or distorting something else. Mm-hmm. But that's an art of its own. I'm not actually very good in explaining how the filters work. But let's say that you have a signal and you are interested in, should we say, alpha band activity. And then you design a filter that reduces all the frequencies that is below that band and that is above it. But the effect is not like everything that's below would be shut down and everything would, which is above it would be gone. They are still there, especially in the edges. Mm. But they are dampened. Well, we'll see a couple of examples of this when we are doing the MATLAB session. Well, filtering. Every phenomena has their own characteristic frequency range. And we can exclude the other, well, not completely exclude, but we can try to highlight the frequencies that we are interested in by filtering the signal. So for instance, EMG, the muscle activity, it's very fast. We are talking about in excess of 60 Hz up to 200, well, you know, 250. Yeah. So we are interested in fast oscillations. So we can, if we put the cutoff point so that anything below 50 Hz would not be in the data, that would be quite safe. It would reduce the slowish oscillations, which are very large, then they can significantly distort your, or mess up your analysis of EMG. But something else would be gone too. But I think it's very safe to assume that if you apply this kind of filter, your EMG is there. There might be something else too, but the EMG is highlighted there. And EEG, well, this depends a lot on what you are interested in. But typically, we are mostly interested in the slow oscillations, so the wideband EEG would be like 0.1 to 60 Hz, which you are recording. And even after that, you will do some filtering to highlight your specific frequency regions of interest. But there are some things that regard the sampling rate of the AD converter here. Well, actually, this should be under the heading of AD converting, but let's deal with it here. So, what happens when you record this analog signal? Analog signal is a continuous signal that has every possible value between certain peak and trough. But digital signal is not like that. Digital signal is points taken every now and then, and then the value is this. So digital signal always looks like this. Like your pixels in a display, they are digital. And if you have lots of pixels, you have a low resolution and your images are bad. The more you have pixels, the more fine-grained image you can have. And the same applies here. if you take a sample very many times per second, you can very well describe the properties of the signal of interest. But if you don't follow the Nyquist rule, what happens is that you will generate frequencies that are not there at all, or you miss some information. Now, if you're interested in daily fluctuation in temperature, body temperature, and you always record your body temperature in the morning, and then you plot them as a function of day, let's say per month, what you're going to have is a flat line. And then you would conclude that, well, body temperature doesn't fluctuate as a function of time, which is not true, of course. Then your sampling rate would have been too slow. You should increase that. So if you did that, let's say, once per hour, you would have a nice fluctuation of body temperature as a function of data. So it's crucial to set up the sampling frequency so that it grasps the signal that you're interested in effectively and doesn't do anything that we can refer to as aliasing. How do you pronounce that? I'm talking to you. How do you pronounce aliasing?
Aliasing.
So, if you fail to follow this rule, so the Nyquist rule is that you take the highest frequency in the range of your interest, and then you multiply that by 2, and then you will cover your signal reasonably well.